Welcome to this episode 4 of Muhammad's Criminal Enterprise, How a War Made a Prophet, as told in the Islamic Hadith and the Quran. This is the Yahwa blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn. If you recall in our last episode from the Rainbow Studio, we affirmed that the raid on his kin at Badr, this would be Muhammad's extended family, the Quraysh, was a thieving attempt to steal what belonged to his extended family. The both Quran recital and the Hadith oral reports from this moment confirmed unambiguously that Muhammad was hunting humans for the slave trade, for kidnap and ransom, that he intended to kill, that his wannabe God was indeed murderous on this occasion and was out for blood, and that the intent of both was to finance Islam's war machine with property stolen from others. This being the case, and it is irrefutable, there is no one that is aware of any aspect of the Quran and the Hadith, the religion of Islam, Muhammad, and the origins of this reprehensible doctrine that can deny any of this. And because it is true, it means that Islam was founded on stealing, on enslaving people, on kidnap for ransom, on bloodlust, thievery, armed robbery. These points are undeniable. You can say whatever you want to and pretend that Islam is a noble, worthy religion, but it does not change the facts. Muhammad was a sand pirate. He was a disgusting, reprehensible human being. Just a common thief. As we return to Tabati, volume 7, page 54, I remind you that all citations from Tabati, which is the Tariq, Tabati was Islam's first Quran commentator. He was Islam's first historian. His hadith collections are irrefutable. They are as valid as the Quran itself. They came from exactly the same people in the same place at the same time and were passed on to us in exactly the same way as is the case with the Quran. And without them, the Quran is indecipherable, and with them, Islam can be practiced. They are Sunnah. The statements that I will be citing all come from the State University of New York's translations and publications. When we turn to Ibn Ishaq's Sirat Rasul Allah, which was the first to collect hadith, these oral reports from Muhammad and his companions, in a collection that he called The Life of Allah's Messenger, we will be citing Guillaume's translation and its publication by Oxford University Press. When we turn to the Quran, I deployed 66 English translations to comprise the translations that I will be sharing with you. I relied heavily on new interlinears that present the Quran literally word for word. The most impressive of those, and the one that you will hear cited the most, is the word for word interlinear that was prepared by the team that published and translated most popular Quran translation in the world. It's called the Noble Quran. It is sponsored by the Saudi Arabian royal family. and there are tens of millions of copies published every year, the most authoritative Quran in the world. And at times, I will add my knowledge of Hebrew, which was bastardized to create the Arabic of the Quran, so that we have greater insights. Now, in this next statement, we find that Muhammad had a new Qibla, and that in his view, if he and his band of pirates perished on this day, that Allah would be no more. Now, that's quite a statement. So first, I will tell you about the change in Qibla. Initially, Muhammad turned to the Qibla that would have been the pagan shrine to rock gods in Petra, which is where he was born and raised. There was no Mecca during the lifetime of Muhammad. It's easily proven archaeologically. The Kaaba was moved about 100 years after Muhammad's death when competing forces were vying for control of this new terrorist religion that was plundering the world. And so the initial Qibla was either that of the rock pile to rock gods in the religious town of Petra, or they turned to Jerusalem. And you can take your pick, but the fact is that he's clean here, that he has a new Qibla, which means a new direction in prayer, which means if it is now towards Mecca and Saudi Arabia, it was not towards Mecca at that time. And that gives you only two options: Jerusalem, which of course Muslims covet, or it would be the rock pile to rock gods in Petra. Then he said, Allah, if this band perishes today, you will be worshipped no more. Now, I can tell you quite frankly that a god that would want to be worshipped is not a god. Any being that says that they want an inferior being to worship them has a psychotic, narcissistic issue. It would be like us humans if we even had the capacity to create a slug that could burp out, boy, you're really wonderful. I love you. You are the bestest. I'm going to prostrate. Let me learn that prostration thing. If I could only get my head down and my butt up, I could curl like that and I could burp out, you're no god but Allah. Any being that would do that and find that meaningful, something that they would desire, something they would demand, is psychotic, is so insecure as not to be worth knowing. I mean, can you imagine about the fifth time that slug burped out and slithered its butt up towards you that say that you are the best? I mean, if you were not insane, you would immediately say, okay, that was a bad idea. Let's enough of that already. Let's stop with it. So the very fact that Allah wants to be worshipped means that he is likely Satan and not God, because Satan is the Lord. He is the one who wants to control, to possess, to impose his influence. And so Satan wants to be worshipped as if he were a god, where the actual god simply wants a familial relationship with us. The other part of that, it you will be no more, suggests that a thug leading a band of raiders in the desert that were about to murder their own family so they could steal property that did not belong to them were the only thing that were standing between Allah being known and not known any longer. That being the case, Allah's not much of a being, is he? I mean, it would render Allah the likes of a snake in the desert if this is the tenuous link to him being known. The next statement reads, Tabari, Volume 7, page 54. Abu Bakr picked up his cloak, and he put it on him, grasping him from behind. O Prophet, whom I value more than my mother and my father, this constant calling on your Lord is annoying. Then Allah revealed, when you sought to help your Lord, he answered you saying, I will help you with 1,000 angels rank upon rank. Muslims will do anything to try to validate the Quran, and this hadith, of course, attempts to do that. That is Quran 8009, which we will cover every episode of the every word of the Quran's 8th surah pursuant to this terrorist raid. But imagine, Abu Bakr is the piece of worm rot that was father of the decade in Arabia that offered his six-year-old daughter to be sexually abused by his bud Muhammad, who was 66 at the time, should he have been born as the Quran suggests in the year of the elephant. I know that is 666, and that'll tantalize a number of you, but nonetheless, 66-year-old freaks don't belong anywhere around six-year-old girls unless it is to play grandpa, and then you're playing dollies and tea sets and on swings in the garden, you are not hopping in bed alone and taking advantage of them sexually. That is exceedingly perverse. We call it pedophilia. And so this was the pedophile prophet. And to say to someone, I value you more than my mother and my father, is when they are sexually abusing your daughter and they're about to lead a gang of hoodlums to rob your extended family, saying that Abu Bakr, who became the stalwart of Islam and the first caliph, did not have a moral compass or a functioning conscience. Now this, your calling on your Lord is annoying for a number of reasons. One is that in Yathrib, where Muhammad bought all of his Quran recitals from rabbis, from them reciting their Talmud to him, the rabbis managed to convince Muhammad that Lord was rabbi. And so that is the Arabic word that underlies this. They were yanking his chain, and he bought it. And for the most stalwart of all Muslims to say, you calling, telling Muhammad that you calling on your Lord is annoying, tells us that Islam was nothing but a farce, that this was nothing more than an excuse to commit armed robbery. And it was not then that Allah revealed anything. The Quran surah, the 8th surah, that begins by saying the stealing is lawful and good, came after this tussle between pirates and commercial traders, not before it or during it. And then this idea, I will help you with 1,000 angels, there is no such thing as an angel. The concept of an angel actually is a corruption from the Christian New Testament. When the writers of the Christian New Testament, beginning with Paul, who wrote the first 14 books of the Christian New Testament and inspired the next three, when he was writing in Greek, he translated the Hebrew word for spiritual messenger, which is malak, into agelos in Greek. At the very least, what he should have done, if he wanted it to be a title, as it's used here, is to transliterate it as malak. And at the very least, then Christians, when they were translating their New Testament out of Greek into a language like English, should have translated the translation of malak as messenger. There is no justification whatsoever for angels. They don't exist. But again, Muhammad and his pals were too stupid to know that. They were, after all, illiterate. And I can also assure you that malak, spiritual messengers and envoys, Do not join sand pirates to kill their kin. They are not engaged in armed robbery. They are not mass murderers. They do not come down to fight battles rank on rank. And in Islam, there has never been an instance ever where Allah did anything. He is the most impotent of wannabe gods in human history. Allah's angels are, of course, so feeble, it takes 1,000 of them to do battle with some intoxicated merchants if you want to actually play along with this story. 1,000 of them to do battle with some intoxicated merchants. And lest we forget, the future caliph found Muhammad's mumblings about Allah and his prayer annoying. He was there for the booty, and he wanted to get along with it now. So Muhammad cried out. This is recorded both in Bukhari, Volume 5, Book 59, Number 330, and in Ibn Ishaq's Sirah, page 300. Here is Gabriel. He's holding the rein of a horse. The last time he was on a jackass, by the way. And he's leading the charge. And he is equipped with his weapons. And he is ready for the battle. Dust on his front teeth. This is the third time that we have heard that Muhammad envisioned Gabriel as a warrior spirit riding on a horse. Now, why a spiritual being would need a form of animalistic mobility is anyone's guess, because as a spiritual being, they can maneuver in time and space at their choosing. They are always depicted, of course, with wings, only because one form of them, the Karub, of which Hasatan was actually a Karub. He was one of the Karub on the walls of Eden, which is how he was able to come down and fool Chawa, is because he was a known entity. And Karub do have wings, but we don't know if the rest of the host in this regard are winged or not. They can certainly appear so, I guess, if they wish to, but they do not ride horses. As for dust on their front teeth, they don't have teeth either. They're spiritual beings. Now, I have shared this before, but it bears repeating, and my job is to correct the incorrect when the incorrect are wrong about something that is important to correct. And in this case, Gabriel isn't a malak. He is not an angel. He could not come down on a horse holding the reins, leading the charge. Gabriel, which means God's most capable and courageous man, it is from Gabor, which is in turn from Gabar. And it speaks of a man who is very capable, bold, someone who is very impressive. And Gabriel would be an impressive man for God. When he is introduced to us, not only does his title tell us he is a man, a human being, but Daniel, which is where he came to visit when he was in Babylon, specifically tells us on two occasions that Gabriel was an Ish, which is a human man. So Gabriel is only brought into these lies interwoven to create the myth of Islam, because while Muhammad was around the Kaaba in Petra, there were a number of Christians who were running away from the influence of Rome, and they were fooled in their gospels to believing that an angel named Gabriel provided a birth announcement to a woman who never existed, by the most horrendous of all Hebrew names, Miriam. Miriam means contentious, rebellious, and embittered. To give birth to a mythical misnomer, the counterfeit of Dode, named Iesu Christu. But the Christians there in Petra in the 7th century would not have known any of this. And so they believed that if you were somebody important, that surely Gabriel would have been the angel that would have provided all of the announcements. So Muhammad bit, and he incorporated the myth of Gabriel into his stories actually told us that Gabriel delivered the Quran. Nothing could be further from the truth. Gabriel is Dod, the person whom Yahweh says, "This is my son, I am his father." Dod is the Messiah, not only the Son of God. He was the king who united Israel and established its capital in Jerusalem and came to possess the Temple Mount. He is the returning king who will obliterate all traces of Islam upon his return, which will be in 8.5 years, if you want to mark it on your calendar. Sunset in Jerusalem, 6:22 p.m. on October 2nd, 2033. That is year 6,000, yeah. So every bit of this was just poppycock, a complete and utter lie. What they were trying to do is the same thing that Islam exists to accomplish everywhere, is to give mass murder, thievery, the slave trade, which were the businesses of Islam, a divine veneer. That's the purpose, no other reason. Muhammad was either hallucinating or just lying through his teeth. Not only, as I've shared, is Gabriel a man and not an angel, and just so happens that he is God's champion against religion and those who would harm his people. It is yet another ignorant proclamation by the man who never found a lie that he didn't like. I have said over and over again, as I try to protect Israel from this horrible menace of Islam, that if it wasn't for lies, Islam wouldn't exist. If it weren't for lies, there would be no Quran. And that's literally true. So even if we were to take a year's supply of stupid pills and play along, why would a spiritual being have weapons when a blast of energy would be vastly more efficient? What would an angel who Muhammad claimed had 600 wings do with a horse? Or was Gabriel really Muhammad's alter ego? And why was he such a dirty fighter? Bukhari, Volume 5, Book 59, Number 327. Gabriel came to the prophet and said, "How do you view the warriors of Badr?" The prophet said, "I see the fighters as the best Muslims." On that, Gabriel said, "And so are the angels who are participating in the Badr battle." I have said it 10,000 times, and I will say it 10,000 times more. According to Muhammad, Allah, the Quran, and Hadith, good Muslims are killers. The best Muslims are all terrorists. Every good Muslim seeks to be a murderer. And I say that because Allah orders all good Muslims to fight and kill for him. They are to engage in jihad, which is always presented as fighting to the death, killing non-Muslims. And Allah is clear multiple times in his Quran, saying that if a Muslim doesn't want to engage in jihad, if he does not want to fight and kill for Allah, then he ceases to be a Muslim. So you cannot be a peaceful Muslim, according to the Quran. Allah calls them hypocrites, and he tells good Muslims, who are all jihadists, to kill the hypocrites so that he can torture them personally in the hottest places of hell. So this idea that there is such a thing as a moderate Muslim is a complete fabrication of the Quran and of Islam. A person who is peaceful, who claims to be a Muslim, is lying to you and to themselves. I see the fighters as the best Muslims. Since the best Muslims fight against civilians for booty, Muhammad agrees with me. All good Muslims are bad people. Further, Allah's best angels are demons. Is this a great religion or what? The prophet said when he was in his awning, remember they made a little palm frut fort for the prophet, since he was so old and decrepit at this time, and he needed to keep up his energy, of course, for pedophilia and incest, which were his prime occupations. Allah, keep your contract and your promise. Well, Satan's contract with his nonprofit had initially traded submission and his soul, along with a will to deceive everyone, for a founder's share in the Kaaba Inc. But for now, that was just pushed aside for a new source of revenue. With his ungod sponsorship, terrorist raiding parties would make Muhammad rich, assert his influence over those he despised, and keep him amply sexed. The only way Abu Bakr would say the following is if he were in on the scam. This is Bukhari, volume 5, number 59, number 289. Abu Bakr took his hand and say, "This is enough, Prophet. You have tired your Lord with your pestering." Abu Bakr knew it was all for show. All they were doing was justifying being thieves and mass murderers. That's something to think about, isn't it? This is enough. You have tired your Lord with your pestering. The next line distinguishes Muhammad from the prophets he claimed were his peers. Bukhari, volume 5, book 59, number 289. Muhammad was wearing his coat of mail. Gee, I don't recall seeing one of those on Moshe, on Samuel, on Dod, on Yashaya, on Hosha, on Zachariah, on Malachi, on Yoel. Nope. But Muhammad was a profiteer with an F, not a prophet with a PH. Those who serve with God are protected by him. How else do you suppose that I could have survived the last 23 years and being one who has eviscerated Islam, tearing the religion apart by exposing its own scriptures? So armor was something that Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Yishak, Jacob, Moshe, Yosha, Shamuel, and Dod would never need. Nor did they say, in fact, I recall the first time that Shaul, who was the people's choicest king, offered Dod, who might have been in his early teens at the time, his coat of armor for him to fight Goliath. And Dod took it off and said, "Nah, this is just in the way. I won't need this." Nor did any actual prophet say, Bukhari 5, 59, 289, "They will be routed and will turn and flee. The hour of doom for them is appointed in this tryst, and it will be more wretched and more bitter than this earthly failure." Quran 54, 45. In other words, to hell with them. They weren't just going to butcher them. They weren't just going to rob them. The victims were going to go to hell. And that is the nature of Islam all the way through the Quran. The victims of these lies, the Jews, the infidels, when they were innocent, going about their lives, and Muslims came down upon them to enslave them, to rob them, to tax them into oblivion, and to kill them, to rape them. According to Allah and the Quran, it's the victims that go to hell. It's kind of like rape in Islam. The woman who is raped receives 100 lashes. The man is exonerated because women are nothing but property. The hour of their doom is appointed, and it will be more wretched for them, more bitter than this earthly failure. So thus far, from a religious perspective, the Battle of Badr has been a complete bust. But things were about to change. Tabari 7, page 55. Milhajah, the mullah, the slave of Umar, who was the future caliph, was struck by an arrow and killed. He was the first Muslim to die. Yes, the first Muslims had slaves. They were slave traders. Milhajah's death must have rattled the militants because Muhammad was forced to preach a sermon that would make the prophet of doom. And as we share the sermon from the prophet of doom, keep in mind that Umar, the second caliph of Islam, the caliph that led the war of compulsion in Arabia and then began to plunder the known world, killing 100 million people to establish Islam, that he, rather than fight himself at this stage, sent his slave forward, and his slave was killed. Doesn't speak well of his character, does it? Ishaq, page 300, Tabari 755. Allah's messenger went out to his men. Oh, he left the front. And he incited them, what, to pray? Nope. To preach Islam? Nope. To share a Quran recital? No. To incite them to fight. He promised every man may keep all the booty he takes. Oh, rather than just getting 80% with the prophet getting his share, Mr. Prophet, or Mr. Non-Prophet, as I should say, was shaking in his sandals, hence wanted to up the ante. Oh, you get to keep it all this time. Oh, he would renege on that, by the way. He was good at lying. The prophet said, by Allah, if any man fights today and is killed, fighting aggressively and always going forward and never retreating, Allah will cause him to enter paradise. In Islam, it is a fight to the death. If in the Quran, throughout the Quran, this very notion is repeated on and on again, that Muslims have either died fighting and killing for Allah, or they're waiting their chance, bidding their opportunity to fight and kill for Allah. And of course, any man, and this would include 1 billion today, or any woman, and this would include a billion of them today, who believes that those who are killed by civilians whom they are seeking to plunder, whom they are raping, whom they are enslaving, and whom they are there to kill, are going to be rewarded by a God who is going to cause them to enter paradise, then I will make two claims that are absolutely essential for you to know. The person impersonating God can be none other than Satan that would make that claim. And the person who believes it is not playing with a full deck. You know, this camel doesn't have all of its feet on the ground. That is the dumbest, most immoral thought ever provided by any religion. And yet that is the overriding claim that causes Islamic terrorists to fight, rape, kill, murder, and torture Jews. It does the world a great service to expose and condemn this lie. It is to the advantage even to those who are deceived by it. And of course, it is a huge advantage and extremely compassionate and loving to those who would become their victims. Of course, these were toxic words, sound waves that flittered through the air. And yet, the hellish behaviors they have inspired continue to reverberate 1,400 years later. They were echoed loudly as the Islamic terrorists screamed, "Allahu Akbar," as they committed torturous acts of mass murder, abduction, rape on October 7th of 2023. Mohammed was lying through his rotten teeth, of course. As usual, he personally confiscated 20% of what his mercenaries stole, and no Muslim has ever entered paradise, nor ever will. Hell, though, is guaranteed. Ishaq, page 300, Tabari, 755. Umar, who was holding some dates in his hand and eating them, said, "Fine, fine, this is excellent. Nothing stands between me and my entering paradise except to be killed by these people." He threw the dates, he seized his sword, and he fought until he was slain. The means behind the madness is now in full view. We do the world a great service to expose and condemn this religion. Those who would say that I'm being inappropriate and my overall disdain for, indeed, my commitment to completely eviscerate Islam, to blame the religion on the deaths that it has caused, the destruction that it has caused, would be immoral, ignorant, and irrational. The only way to be compassionate and loving is to despise what this man said, because it has inspired untold pain and suffering on the world and continues to do so. And it will continue to do so for as long as there are too few people that have the chutzpah, that have the courage, that have the backbone, the character, the intellect, the wisdom, the morality, to stand up and hold this goddamn religion accountable for its demonic and deadly appeal. The means behind this Muslim madness is all exposed for you. Muhammad told his militants that their reward was Allah's brothel for wayward jihadists. All they had to do to earn their prize was to die murdering others in pursuit of booty. Now, that is what Muslims believe. They wouldn't be Muslims if they didn't believe that. It's plastered all over the Quran and Hadith. They all call themselves martyrs. They all believe that when they give their life, oh, they go directly to the garden. They kill based upon this lie. We do the world a tremendous service. We do every child, every woman, even every man, a great favor when we expose and condemn the basis of Islam. No one should be allowed to believe, no one should be motivated to kill based upon this bogus promise that killing is good, stealing is good, and that those who die killing, raping, plundering, and stealing are rewarded in heaven. No one should be able to promote Allah as if he were actually a god, or Muhammad, as if he spoke for one. This Muslim militant and disciple who had gone off on a terrorist raid to kidnap defenseless civilians and steal their possessions died shouting these words. They're recorded in Ishaq, page 300. "I am fighting in Allah's cause. This is piety and a good deed in Allah's war. I do not fear as others should, for fighting is righteous, true, and good." If you are a progressive, Greta Thunberg, for example, wearing a sign of Palestinian Muslim allegiance and are off speaking such that Muslims might more readily commit genocide against Jews. If you run a liberal college and are run amok with progressives and Muslims shouting death to America, death to Jews, if you are among these people, you have no conscience. You have no morality. You are devoid of the ability to think rationally or to respond to the evidence. If you are a Muslim, you are either a complete nincompoop or you are a deadly killing machine. Neither one should be respected or even tolerated. I am fighting in Allah's cause. It is plastered again all through the Quran. Allah demands that all Muslims fight in his cause. It is considered the ultimate in piety and a good deed in Allah's war against all humankind. I do not fear as others should. And I want to tell you, they should be very afraid, because the consequence of their behavior for 1400 years has earned them a confirmed reservation in Sheol. For this, fighting is righteous, true, and good. Only if you are a legionnaire in Rome, if you are part of the gang of Genghis Khan, but for a religion to elevate fighting to the ultimate symbol of righteousness, that killing is good, that religion should be quarantined and people should not be harassed by it. Consider the number of times the Quran has spoken of righteous, true, and good deeds. Now we know Allah's definition of piety, and what is a good deed actually represents fighting to the death, killing others. We also found that Muhammad's definition of a good Muslim was accurate, albeit horrific. All good Muslims are vicious terrorists. Now keep in mind, this particular battle was not defensive. Muhammad wasn't protecting his people. He was not trying to spread Islam. He had no interest in Islam. He went out on a terrorist raid expressly because he thought that the caravan that he was trying to rob was lightly protected and that he could launch a surprise attack on it and abduct his own extended family members, because that's who he was going after. And he could abduct them for ransom, that he could steal their property, and that he could get his jollies killing them. This was the worst form of terrorism. You know, mostly terrorists fight for some religious or political agenda. Muhammad wasn't. Muhammad was fighting exclusively for his own self-aggrandizement, for his own quest, covetousness, for sex, power, and money, his own bloodlust, his own revenge against his kin. Muslim lives were meaningless to Muhammad, just as Islamic clerics find suicide bombers and jihadists expendable. Hamas is hiding among civilians because they believe that the more Muslims who die, the better it is for them. They want the maximum carnage. That was the intent of 10/7, the flood of Alaska. Raphael Lemkin coined the term genocide in 1944 as part of his analysis of what Europeans, Roman Catholics and Nazis, communists and Muslims, and especially Muslims, and their racist and conspiratorial collaborators did to the Jewish population in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s. The term was based upon the Greek word for race, genos, and the Latin word for kill, side. It is defined as the deliberate mass extinction of a race. The previous example was perpetrated by the Ottoman Turks, also Muslims, against the Christian Armenians at the conclusion of the First World War. And this I want to make clear to you. I've stated this now many times on social media and Facebook and on X, showing pictures that prove the point. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis thought that they could rob Jews and exile them. And that was their plan through 1941. All of the meetings detail their plans to exile Jews. Then, in November of 1941, the highest ranking Muslim in what is now Israel, the Grand Mufti, had an audience with Adolf Hitler, and they discussed killing Jews as opposed to exporting Jews. And as a result of that meeting, a Muslim convinced the Nazi that Jews, rather than being exiled, should be exterminated. At the next meeting of Nazis and SS leadership, the agenda is quite clear, and it details the final solution, where the concentration camps would all be turned into death camps, and that the Jews of Europe would be killed, not exiled. So the Holocaust and the extermination of 6 million Jewish lives, a million of them babies, was caused by a Muslim. Now, I share all of this because the claim that is being made against Israel on behalf of the fakestinians, while the reverse is true, needs to be extinguished. It is Muslims by every ethnicity that are trying to annihilate one ethnicity, Jews, which is the meaning of the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free of Jews." Not only are the so-called Palestinians unrelated by race, nationality, or history, and only by religion, Israel has unintentionally killed an insignificant fraction of 1% of Muslims, even of fakestinian non-combatants. And even for the vast majority of those killed, while Israel appropriately seeks to protect its people from another attack and hold the perpetrators of the recent savagery accountable, the preponderance of their deaths are directly attributable to Hamas using Muslims as human shields. Gazan lives mean less to the Islamic leadership than they do to the Jews, who put their shoulders at risk to protect them. In that light, Muhammad issued the Suicide Bomber's Creed, not for himself, mind you. Ishaq 300, Tabari 756. O Messenger of Allah, what makes the Lord, Rabbi, laugh with joy at his servant? He replied, when he plunges his hand into the midst of an enemy without armor. So Auf took off his coat of mail that he was wearing and he threw it away. And then he took his sword and fought the enemy until he was killed. Well, is it any wonder that Muslim bomb makers want their children to grow up and become jihadist killers? There's only one voice of Islam, Muhammad. And he just said that the only thing that makes Allah smile is when an Islamic killer thrusts his sword into an enemy while he himself is vulnerable without any protection. That way, both die. And that really is Allah's intent. Allah, as Hasatan, is anti-human. He wants everyone to die. Well, this is all clear. I am perplexed by what Muhammad said. It is odd that he didn't need an angelic revelation to know what made Allah laugh with joy. And it sounds as if Allah likes to do the plunging and killing. Further, can you fathom a religion built around a spirit who prefers death to salvation, or salvation by death? Yep. You die killing for me. I've given you all the promises that you're going to be in a brothel forevermore. And then you do the unspeakable. You rape, plunder, and kill Allah, only to find out that he lied to you all along. Welcome to hell, pal. Welcome to Allah's domain. Then in a tome as demented as the spirit guiding him, we read in Ishaq 301 and Tabari 756, Muhammad picked up a handful of pebbles and he faced the Quraysh. He shouted, "May their faces be deformed." He threw the pebbles at them and he ordered his companions to attack. The foe was routed. Allah killed Quraysh chiefs and caused many of their nobles to be taken captive. While the Muslims were taking prisoners, Muhammad was in his hut. End quote. This is the two earliest, most credible sources of the words and deeds of Muhammad. Ishaq and Tabari. They both report the exact same hadith. Muhammad, the scummy sand pirate, the godfather of his criminal enterprise, picked up a handful of pebbles. And he faced the Quraysh, who was his family, his neighbors, that he had come to rob and to kill. And he said, "May their faces be deformed." He was sadistic. He was a psychopath. Sadistic psychopaths don't typically make good prophets, just to throw that out there. He threw more pebbles at them, and he ordered his companions, what, to preach Islam? Nah. To make peace? No, not a chance. To only take half of the booty? Nope. To attack. And the foe was Muhammad's family, his neighbors. And if that were not bad enough, the Islamic wannabe god, Allah, is credited with doing the killing. Allah killed the Quraysh. The Quraysh were the custodians of his goddamn rock pile called the Kaaba. And as thanks, Allah claims to have killed them. And he killed their chiefs and caused many of their nobles to be taken captives. To call them chiefs and nobles is such a preposterous idea. People living around the Kaaba and Petra at the time were just trying to stay alive. The source of water, the aqueduct that had made it a thriving religious metropolis for the Nabataeans was long gone. The Nabataeans had left. The Romans then took it over for a number of years. They all left. And the reason they left is that there was a tremendous earthquake, and the earthquake destroyed the aqueduct such that it was nothing but a sand pit. And there was nobody that was a chief. There was nobody that was noble in this aging and crumbling sand pit. But it's got to make them look like they were big time operators. Otherwise, what was Allah doing out there killing them? And of course, while the Muslims were taking prisoners, now that means they were abducting them. They were not prisoners. They were kidnapped for ransom, just as the Muslims did on 10-7. You want to understand what happened on 10-7, you have to understand what Muhammad did here at Badr, and what he did at Kabar, and what he did at Yathrib in perpetrating genocide against Jews, enslaving them, and here against his own people, kidnapping them for ransom and killing them. Muhammad and his spirit were demonic, the very personification of evil. It's amazing that even in Arabia, there were room for two narcissistic psychopaths of this ilk, Allah and Muhammad. This is a good point for us to conclude this, the fourth episode of the Yahwa blog on Muhammad's criminal enterprise, how war made a prophet. I look forward to returning to the Rainbow Studio at this time tomorrow to share more insights into why the only moral, just, rational, compassionate, and loving response to the religion of Islam is to expose it, condemn it, and to isolate it, to quarantine this plague of mass destruction. Thank you for listening.